The presidential elections in Honduras went ahead yesterday despite being shunned by most of the international community and many Hondurans critical of the June coup. With most of the votes counted, early results show a 52% win for conservative candidate Porfirio Lobo. Military and police presence in and around the capital, Tegucigalpa, was reportedly high. While the coup regime claimed they were security measures in case ousted President Manuel Zelaya's supporters caused disruptions, human rights groups asserted that the forces were meant to intimidate Zelaya's supporters from demonstrating. In fact, the day before the election, one man was reportedly shot in the head at a military roadblock in Tegucigalpa as he drove past and is currently in critical condition in the hospital. Meanwhile, in the Honduran city of San Pedro Sula, a peaceful protest of pro-democracy protesters were reportedly tear-gassed, with several people being beaten and arrested. Amnesty International has denounced violence during the election and called on the Honduran authorities to reveal the identities, whereabouts, and charges against all people detained on the eve and day of the presidential elections. We turn now back to Tom Loudon, co-director of the Quixote Center, who joined us last week in ahead of the elections. He was in San Pedro during the elections where the violence broke out, and he's now joining us live from Honduras. Welcome to Uprising. Hi,
Tom. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Doing well. Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about what exactly happened in San Pedro. You were there, and on your website, you've posted several photographs of the violence. What happened?
Well, the people of San Pedro decided to do a peaceful march to express their repudiation of the elections, and we were there observing. There were about 500 people, and when the march got to the center of the city, there was a gathering happening in the Central Park, and there was probably going to be some speakers and whatnot, but before that could happen, there was a big water tank and several truckloads of police and military who put on gas masks and then began shooting tear gas and shooting their water mixed with pepper gas at the crowd. And the police essentially rushed the crowd and sent people running and off in all different directions. And they chased them down. There were about 38 people arrested. We went around later in the afternoon to different detention centers, and everyone that we talked to had been arrested, had been beaten, kicked up, beaten with nightsticks, all during their ride to the police station, to the different police stations that they went to. One young man, we didn't see him, but they said that his hand was so badly broken that it was probably going to be amputated.
So these were protesters who were just basically declaring their discontent with the election. They weren't attacking any polls. What were they doing that could have provoked this, you think?
Well, I assure you they were not doing anything. In fact, we have some videos that, if they're not posted yet, they'll be posted very soon on the Quixote Center website. I put them on YouTube last night, and they show clearly the protesters were actually sitting on the street when, in front of the big tank, the tank that sprays water, and when the police began putting on their gas masks, then the people stood up. But people were actually just sitting on the street, not doing anything, and they stood up, getting ready to run. And then, sure enough, within about 5 minutes, the tear gas began, and then for about 2 hours, people just the police were they had about 10 square blocks militarized, and you know, like 2 hours after this, we were sitting out in front of our hotel. I was in the van, some other people were on the street in our delegation. The police just came by and lobbed two canisters of tear gas within just a few feet of us. So we were exposed to tear gas twice.
I'm speaking with Tom Loudon, who is the co-director of the Quixote Center. He, along with a delegation of human rights activists, have been in Honduras. He was in San Pedro yesterday, where the violence occurred that he's just been describing, about 500 people peacefully gathering to protest the elections and attacked with tear gas, many beaten and arrested. Now, Tom, I understand that Amnesty International, as I mentioned, has called on authorities to reveal the whereabouts of anybody who was arrested, and apparently it's not known where some people were taken. What do you know of where the people who were arrested were taken?
Well, we visited a couple of detention centers. From my understanding, and there may have been more people arrested than we knew about, there were 38 people arrested, and by last evening, they had all been released. So I'm not aware of other people who may have been arrested and still in detention. They were all released and not charged with anything. But, you know, they suffered severe beatings.
Let's talk about
in fact, there's a video of one young man who we saw who came out of the police detention and was on his way to the hospital because he had been, that's the other thing, they were sprayed. While they were detained, they were sprayed in the face with pepper spray. And he couldn't open his eyes. He had, like, blisters on his face from the pepper spray.
Let's talk about the election itself. So as I mentioned, the conservative candidate, Porfirio Lobo, has declared victory. It seems that he got 52% of the vote. The major issue that everybody had been waiting to watch was the turnout. And there were, of course, calls for boycotts, as we talked about last week. But the Christian Science Monitor claimed that despite calls for boycott, turnout seemed to be no lower than normal. Is that true?
That didn't seem to be the case for us. In fact, you know, during the afternoon, after the police repression in the park, we visited several polling places, and of about a dozen different rooms that I visited and took pictures in, I only saw one person voting, you know, actually while we were there. And so we were there for the different polling places for over an hour. I really only saw one person who was actually voting.
So most of them were empty?
The last place that we went to, they were totally empty. The last place that we went, they have the ballots, like for each room, there's like a bound book with the ballots. And it was probably about 3:30, and some of the polls closed at 4 and some closed at 5. But at that hour, in the one that I was looking at very closely, of a book that had about 300 ballots in it, which would be how many people would be registered for that particular room. If there were 50 that had been taken off of that pack, it was a lot. It was just unbelievable. There was a huge stack of ballots still there. And obviously, you know, in the short time remaining, there wouldn't be very many people who would be voting. Now, I'm sure that varies in different locations, that there are some places where more people voted than others. But, also, we had heard prior to the elections that there were 4.6 million voters registered. And in the last election, about 44% of the people voted. And so what we've heard in terms of numbers of people voted, it's about 1.2 million, which would be about 25%. So I would say that's a pretty significant abstention rate.
And I understand that voting was much higher in wealthier neighborhoods, pro-business neighborhoods, where support for the coup regime would be expected to be quite high.
Yes, we visited polls in each of those kinds of locations, and clearly people were, you know, more animated, and it seemed like that there was probably more of a turnout in the more wealthy areas.
Now, it's interesting to take a look, of course, at what happens from this point onwards, both internationally and in Honduras itself. The media here has been casting the election as, well, there's now hope that Hondurans can move on from the coup. And it's sort of being cast in this way as that the election, contested as it might be, or contested as the premise of the election might be, that at least it might represent a way for Hondurans to move forward. What does that mean for people people on the ground. What does that mean for ousted President Manuel Zelaya, whose term, I suppose, is officially over?
Yes, well, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what it will mean for him, but definitely people in the national resistance movement are clear in maintaining the position that they don't consider this election legitimate, and they're not going to recognize the president, and they're going to keep insisting on the need for a constitutional assembly. So my sense is that, you know, the United States is clearly trying to push very hard for these elections to be recognized. I think part of the problem is they have yet come to recognize the changes that have been happening in Latin America over the last decade. And other than their closest allies, I think no one else in Latin America will recognize these elections. So that's going to obviously put the Honduran de facto government in a difficult position. You know, I know that President Obama has had several tit-for-tats back and forth with Brazil about this. I don't think that this is one of those conflicts that the U.S. is going to have their way in. Hmm. That's my thinking.
So the newly elected government, and of course the word elected has to be treated with some skepticism here, but that government of Lobo, Porfirio Lobo, now it seems as though his biggest allies are going to be the U.S., Costa Rica, and Panama, the three countries in the world that chose to recognize these elections, alienating Honduras from the rest of Latin America. Well, finally, Tom, let me ask you what you think this represents for Latin America as a whole. Last time we talked about how Honduras was being seen as symbolic for many Latin American countries who had hoped to leave behind the legacy of right-wing dictatorship sponsored by the United States. And Honduras is the first coup in over a decade in the region. So what do you think it bodes for the future of Latin America?
Well, you know, I think that essentially the United States position essentially is that, you know, they wouldn't articulate it this way, but what the meaning of their position is that the coup is being allowed to stand, and a government is being put in place that was, you know, that was chosen under a coup regime. again, I think that it's a position that is, you know, I hope will... You know, I hope that they will soon come to recognize what's happening all in our hemisphere around them, because my sense is that the majority of countries here, they still consider that this is a threat to each one of their existence, and so are going to hold firm and are going to say, you know, we need a new process. And so perhaps what this will move for, you know, when we talk to the presidential candidate, Carlos H. Reyes, the other day, who pulled out of the elections, he said, well, you know, we think that the only legitimate way forward then is once these things happen that they call elections is that we move to a constituent assembly, and so then we have a true chance to start over from that place. And so that's what the people here are going to be pushing, the people from the resistance movement. And I think there's going to be a lot of support in Latin America for that process to happen.
And we will link, Tom, to your website for your reports from the elections. I want to thank you so much once more for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tom Loudon is... Tom Loudon is co-director of the Quixote Center, joining us live from Honduras, where he and other members of a human rights delegation were in Honduras to observe the election, and they were in San Pedro yesterday during the election, where violence broke out. 500 unarmed protesters were attacked by the coup regime authorities. Again, their website is quixote.org. That's Quixote.org. We'll also link to that from our site. You can find photographs and a report from their delegation on that website. This is Uprising. Our site is kpfk.org/uprising. Later in the hour, In Pursuit of the Gene, from Darwin to DNA, James Schwartz will join us in studio. And after the short break, the end of California. Stay tuned.
This is Jim Lafferty with this important public service message. President Obama is expected to disclose his new plan for Afghanistan, which may include a large troop buildup, sometime between November 30th and December 4th, most likely on Tuesday, December 1st. Anti-war groups in L.A. have called for a protest over his plan at 5 p.m. at the Westwood Federal Building on the day following the president's announcement. Again, the protest over President Obama's new plan for Afghanistan will take place at the Westwood Federal Building at 5 p.m. on the day following the president's announcement.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Earlier this month, the Nonpartisan Legislative Analyst's Office released a report warning that California could continue to face multi-billion-dollar budget deficits for years to come. It projects that the state will face an immediate $20.7 billion deficit in the upcoming 2010 to 2011 fiscal year. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has until January 10th to present a new spending plan to contend with the continued fiscal woes. Legislative analyst Mac Taylor urged the governor and state lawmakers to begin working on solutions as soon as possible and cautioned that if no permanent fixes are found, California will face budget deficits of at least $20 billion annually through 2015. The harrowing projections come just 4 months after an overdue budget was signed by Schwarzenegger on July 28th that attempted to address the state's $24 billion budget shortfall for this year. Deep cuts were made in education, healthcare, and important social services, and similar slashes may be in store for next summer. Unrest over the burdens imposed by this year's budget have already visibly erupted as University of California campuses across the state became sites of protests and arrests last week over the recent 32% raise in student fees. The continuing crisis has led some to deem California as the first failed state in the union. In a short radio documentary, Uprising intern and Cal State Northridge undergraduate Steve Gill characterizes the situation as the end of California as he traces the effects of the budget cuts on students, teachers, and families while analyzing the roots of the crisis.
2009 was the year that California's social safety net was decimated. Health and Human Services were slashed $527 million, public education was cut $9 billion, and elderly renters were made to absorb a $91 million cut to housing tax credits. Meanwhile, California remains the only major oil-producing state that does not tax its oil companies. But don't take my word for it.
First and foremost, this budget does not raise your taxes. We don't look to the taxpayers or businesses to foot the bill for Sacramento's appetite for spending. The majority of solutions come from deep spending cuts, and they come from three areas, which is healthcare, education, and prisons.
As he approved of the most overdue budget in state history, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger had this to say.
Now, we all know that the negotiations were tough, and it took a little bit longer than expected. But the fact of the matter is that I am very proud of this budget.
The international TV network Al Jazeera even covered this state's budget crisis in a two-part program called California, Failed State.
On this episode of Fault Lines, California crashing. A massive budget crisis in the richest state in the U.S. The solution on the table? Slash social services for the poor.
It will be a catastrophe, the likes of which will be visited on every community in California.
So while legislators were celebrating the passage of a budget that does not raise taxes, mothers scrambled to get their children health care after it was threatened to be cut, students scrambled to sign up for classes before they filled up, teachers scrambled to find jobs before they were cut, workers scrambled to get hours before they were cut, the elderly realized that their voting power was just not enough anymore, and the homeless, well, at least they made new friends as more people continued to lose their homes. Is this the end of California? I'm Steve Gill, a student at California State University, Northridge. This is the story of one of the most progressive states in the union and its fall from grace.
Make sure you have a steady footing in a Zion done.
The sudden cuts in social services this summer left many people wondering how such draconian cuts could have been made. To make matters worse, there was a lack of explanation from California's leadership as to how these cuts came about, making it harder for people to formulate responses. I went to one of my professors and asked him if he could explain what is happening in California.
Tom Hoganesh, Associate Professor of Political Science, Cal State Northridge. Well, I mean, government, it's not just California that has a budget crisis. It's the United States has a budget crisis. Europe has a budget crisis. Individual states, I mean, we all have budget crises. And the reason is that the way that we fund our government is tied to the capitalist system. It's tied to the economic cycles. And so if, for instance, tax revenue is going down because the economy is going down, you're going to have these kinds of cycles. So the real question is not can you ever avoid situations like this entirely, but what can you do to sort of moderate these cycles? Budget crisis in California is nothing new. I mean, we've had severe budget crises in the past. Back in the early 1990s, we had a terrible budget crisis following the recession and the decline of the defense industry in Southern California and the collapse of the housing market. We've had other booms and busts in the budget. When the dot-com busted in 2002, we had another budget crisis. This budget crisis is just an extension of really that pattern in California, that sometimes when the economy is going really well, we have a lot of money in the state coffers, and then when the economic situation is turning downward, we have a budget deficit. It just so happens that this economic downturn is just much worse than anything that we've seen since the 1930s.
Kokai Kwajitahiri is an organizer with Californians for Accountable Leadership, as well as with the Community Coalition of South Los Angeles. In response to the budget cuts, he is calling for the impeachment of Governor Schwarzenegger.
I would like to take people back a little bit, that what Governor Schwarzenegger is doing is what he promised he would do when he was elected in a recall election in 2003, the slash the safety net, and particularly targeting those programs that service and impact those who can least afford to have those cuts, right? The most vulnerable in our society, the poor, the disabled, seniors, and children. And so what he's doing is carrying out that program. But in addition to making the cuts illegal or otherwise to these needed programs, we feel like he's also literally basically not done his job and has been very ineffective in terms of his leadership in the state of California. If you remember in July, just a few months ago, he literally sat on his in his office and basically said to the state legislature, you know what, I know you don't have veto power. You can't override my veto. So basically, I'm going to sit in my office and I'm going to force you to cut and burn programs that many of you have fought for. And people need to understand that because we don't have a 2/3, right, which is a whole other subject, right, he basically has the power to do that. And so what we're saying is this, is as governor of the state of California, he has the primary responsibility for taking care of the people of California. And millions of people are struggling in life and death situations because of the decision-making and the political philosophy of the governor.
I wonder if Governor Schwarzenegger has an answer for Kukai.
I know that college students will pay now higher tuitions. I know that teachers will be laid off. And I know that our state workers will get less money. But we have to do that. It's the only way to solve the problem and to save our great state.
I wonder if Mr. Schwarzenegger truly believes this is the only way to solve the problem. Let us look at a couple of stories that illustrate what Schwarzenegger's solution means for some of us. At the beginning of the 2009 academic school year, students and professors at Cal State Northridge held an event called Vent at the Tent. Here's what the CSUN community had to share.
I'm Professor Michael Hogan. I'm an associate professor in the Cinema and Television Arts Department. I teach filmmaking production.
Has these budget cuts personally affected you?
Oh, yeah.
Could you tell us how?
I may lose my house. So unless the bank will renegotiate with me, I'm in a bit of a fix.
I'm Teresa Montaño. I'm an associate professor of Chicana and Chicana Studies here at Cal State Northridge, and I'm also the California Faculty Association chapter president here at CSUN. We've had three students so far come to the tent and tell us that they've gone to a number of classes to try to get in, and if they're not able to get their classes, they face deportation. So it's not just a question of, if I don't get this class, I can go out and do, you know, get a job somewhere. They don't get these classes, they get deported. I've had teachers come in and say to me, I really need this class. If I don't get this class, I lose my job because I have to have a certain number of units in order to keep my position.
I'm a gender and women's studies professor. We work for social justice and peace. And I think students deserve something much better than what they're getting. And faculty, too. I think we're people, too. We also have to pay our bills. As for my own personal story, too, I cannot pay my bills anymore. I also have a 23-year-old daughter whose health insurance runs out when you turn 23. She has a precondition, so I have to pay $500 a month now for her insurance. She's unemployed, and I have a wage cut, which means that I, as a faculty, as a professor, PhD from an Ivy League institution, I cannot afford food, because after I paid my bills, I don't have anything left over. So, you know, I share the same stories with my students. You know, we are really deeply affected by this crisis.
And how do you see the future of California and the California State University system if these budget cuts continue?
Well, what I see is a dismantling from public education. That I've been seeing this and following it for a long time, but this is a very aggressive move that has been done, you know, to really dismantle public education. The CSU will not be able to continue with these furloughs. I hear that it will not only be this year, but we should expect at least another year of the same. That's enough to really liquidate, what there is left of public education. And as for the future of California, you know, everybody knows that a economy with an uneducated labor force is programmed for failure. And this economy is already a failure. We know that, but then we have no future. And we are sacrificing a whole generation, that is supposed to take over the economy, and it will not be prepared. And we also know that education is not only to get a job and, you know, become a little piece in the economy. We educate people to become citizens in a democracy and to become conscientious beings. And we are not given, we don't even have the time for that anymore. We are all really in, really in economic and social despair, faculty and students. So we should unite. We're all in the same boat here.
Can you tell me your name and your position again?
My name is Brandy Mendoza. I am an associate professor of gender and women's studies.
Thank you.
And I also come from Honduras, where we just had a coup, and I tell my students, I saw millions of dollars pouring into my country to support a military civilian regime. Bring those billions of dollars to California. Hondurans will be very thankful.
Samba la cosa, que viva la astronomía. Caramba y samba la cosa, que viva la astronomía. Me gustan los estudiantes que rugen como los vientos cuando le meten al oído sotanas y regimientos. Pajarillos libertarios igual que los elementos. Caramba y samba la cosa, que viva lo experimento. Caramba y zamba la cosa, que viva lo experimento. Me gustan los estudiantes porque levantan el pecho cuando le dicen harina sabiéndose que es aprecho. Y no se hacen sordomudos cuando se presenta el hecho. Caramba y zamba la cosa, el código del derecho. Caramba y zamba la cosa, el código del derecho.
I also spoke with a constituency that at times seems to disappear in the city, the bus riders. Barbara Lott Holland is co-chair of the Bus Riders Union. She tells me how bus riders have been affected by the budget cuts.
My name is Barbara Lott Holland. I am co-chair of the Bus Riders Union.
Have any members of your community or the community that you serve
been affected by the recent California budget cuts?
All of our members have. Our members are primarily the poor. Black and Latinos and Asian Pacific Islanders is what constitute our membership. They are, the majority of them are transit dependent. Over 60% of those are women and children, and they are very much affected by this. The average household yearly budget, the annual income of our members is like $12,000 a year. So any budget cuts definitely affect them. The majority of our members do rely on what few remaining social services that we have. A lot of our members can't meet meetings now because rather than get a monthly pass, they only travel on the bus when they need to, because that monthly pass now has to go for other things. So it's cut. That alone has cut down on their activities. They are now confined to their home or within walking distance of their neighborhood because they can't find that.
I'm Steve Gill, and you're listening to a special report called The End of California. Jeanette Ali, a resident of South L.A. and a Medi-Cal recipient who is currently caring for her cancer-stricken husband, shares her personal story of the effects of the budget cuts.
When my husband, it started about 2 years ago, and they found out that he had cancer. And so we started receiving IHSS and also a nurse to come out and help us with the services that we needed at home. But since the budget cuts have come into play, whereas the nurse was coming 5 days a week, she has 60 days where she's only allowed to come in for 15 hours within those 60 days. That is a huge dilemma for me as well as my husband, because she provided us with so much mental support, physical support. And without those services, my husband needs shots every day that he needs to take every day. He needs shots that he takes every other day. And without those services, he's not getting his shots because we need that motivation from the nurse who provide us those services. And without those services, I don't feel that he should lose his life because of the cuts that the governor has presented. I just have so many concerns about that, because without those services, he could lose his life.
I wanted to explore deeper how we got to this point. This state that we so proudly tout as the seventh largest economy in the world seems to be crumbling under the weight of the budget cuts. How do we allow this to happen? For answers that are not so immediately evident to us, I turn to the California Budget Project, or CBP, which is a nonprofit research and public education organization that addresses our state fiscal policy. Scott Graves is a senior policy analyst for the CBP. He provided me with some very valuable information regarding our state's fiscal policy.
Let me give you a couple of important factors here that have led to the current crisis. First, over the last 15 years, state policymakers have approved a range of tax cuts that now cost the state about $12 billion per year. That's every year when you add up the cost of the tax cuts that have been made since the early 1990s, that results in $12 billion less coming to the state treasury to support programs and services. We've also seen rapid growth in the prison budget. The state spending on corrections takes up twice as much of the state budget today as it did 20 years ago. So prison spending has gone up, crowding out funds available for other programs and services. A couple of solutions we see. One is we need to rescind corporate tax cuts that have been made in the last couple of years. We have a saying here at the Budget Project: when you're in a hole, stop digging. A lot of Californians are unaware that some of the most recent budget agreements have included big corporate tax breaks that are going to cost the state up to $2.5 billion every year permanently when they're fully implemented in a couple of years. These tax cuts were made even as legislators were grappling with huge budget deficits, and they were slipped into the budget agreements at the last minute without any public hearings. So we feel that, you know, obviously $2.5 billion is a significant amount of money, and that's money that we won't have to go for schools, universities, health care for children if the state keeps these tax cuts in place. So we think the first place to look is to undo a bad policy idea of the last couple of years, which was granting more tax cuts to major multinational corporations that certainly do not need them.
That is huge. That is something that I, in 2004, when I tried to do that, only dreamt of getting done. And as you know, there was tremendous resistance then because our revenues were coming up and because our economy was coming back. But now, because, and this is why I always say that when there's a crisis, there are opportunities. And so we used that opportunity, and this was the only way we got those reforms done.
So maybe our state problems are not a result of budget cuts, but of tax cuts. The government says it's improving our lives by granting tax cuts to the largest corporations. These cuts let said companies keep more of their own money while the state becomes increasingly starved for revenue. It is during times of crisis that such so-called solutions are offered up. Cut the people's safety net while granting even more tax cuts to the corporations. Our governor used the budget crunch to put in place a conservative tax policy. This is the thesis of analyst and writer Naomi Klein, who in her book, The Shock Doctrine, lays out how those in power use the chaos of a crisis to force changes that benefit them. In a 2007 speech, she quoted the late conservative economist Milton Friedman to expose these tactics.
Friedman wrote this in 1982. He said, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable." That there is the manifesto of what I call disaster capitalism, the taking advantage of a moment of crisis, of extreme cataclysmic change, of confusion, and using it to loot the public sphere.
Perhaps the governor is grateful for the crisis.
And this is why I always say that when there's a crisis, there are opportunities.
Some people point to real remedies for avoiding such a crisis in the future.
We also think at the Budget Project that it's important to look at long-term causes of the state's budget crisis, and that is that even when the state's economy is strong, California has budget problems. Now, that's partly because our tax system is outdated. It dates back to the 1930s when the state's economy was based more on the sale of goods than it is now. Now we have a service-based economy, and our tax system, especially the sales tax, which provides a lot of revenue for the state, hasn't been updated to reflect this change from a goods-based economy to a service-based economy. So that means that even in good times, even when the economy is strong, our tax system isn't bringing in enough revenue to support programs and services that Californians expect, including K-12 education, higher education, health and human services. So that's one major long-term cause, that our tax system is outdated. And I'd just like to mention one last issue, which is that California is the only state in the nation that requires a supermajority, two-thirds vote, to get a budget out of the legislature and to pass any tax increase in the legislature. This requirement results in chronic budget gridlock and undermines our policymakers' ability to achieve a real and lasting budget solution.
So, you know, if you're looking for one thing that could be easily fixed and would help the revenue side of California's budget problems, it would be to drop down that two-thirds requirement, down to something more like what other democracies use, which is a majority.
In a manner that conjures images of shock therapy described by Naomi Klein, Governor Schwarzenegger seems grateful that the crisis hit. The largest economy in the United States has fallen victim to the global economic crisis. The year is almost over, but as Californians brace themselves for the signing of next year's budget, our future looks bleak. The complete slash to the safety net that was enacted has led Al Jazeera to describe California as our nation's first failed state. In a way, we have allowed this to happen. How much more will we take?
You've been listening to a special report by Steve Gill, intern for Uprising and an undergraduate student at Cal State Northridge. You can listen to this and all our other interviews archived online at kpfk.org/uprising. Well, without a break, we're going to go right to our last story. 150 years ago on November 24th this year, Charles Darwin published his seminal book, On the Origin of Species. While Darwin's concepts of evolution through natural selection have become political targets of religious zealots everywhere, his scientific work formed the basis of much of what is known today about genetics, one of humanity's greatest achievements. For about a century, scientists worked to understand the building blocks of life and heredity. Often seen as one of the most controversial fields of scientific inquiry, this history has now been written by science writer James Schwartz in his book In Pursuit of the Gene, From Darwin to DNA. Through the lives of a handful of crucial figures, Schwartz tells the often messy story of how gene science came to be understood. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So it's an important year for Charles Darwin's name. Not only was his book published 150 years ago, it's also the 200th anniversary of his birth. How did his work set the stage for the field of inheritance and what eventually came to be known as genetics?
Well, his theory of evolution by natural selection, which is about selecting from among a large number of small differences in organisms. And it depends, the more fit survive and pass on their better qualities to their offspring. And it depends on there being a large number of variations. But Darwin believed at the same time that that inheritance worked as a blending process, that tall fathers marrying short mothers would have average-sized children. And he realized shortly after publishing The Origin that this was a catastrophe for his theory, because in no time at all you'd wipe out all the variation in a population and then evolution would grind to a halt. So he needed to save his theory of natural selection a theory of inheritance. So he set out to work shortly after publishing The Origin. He got busy formulating a theory of inheritance, which he called pangenesis, which depended on particles which came to be known as pangenes and were later shortened to genes. And those are the conceptual beginning of the modern gene.
And from that work, from that basis of Darwin's work, there were many, many different theories, many competing theories, many sort of arenas of competition and a collegiality between different scientists. And in your book, you sort of show that rather than what some scientists might like to think that science is the very sort of sterile and plodding field of scientific inquiry, that it in fact is subject to human nature.
Yeah. I mean, that people view science as sort of a dispassionate sorting out of facts, and it really isn't. In particular, right from the beginning with Darwin, his theory, which depended his theory of inheritance now, he postulated the existence of particles that could be altered by one's life. You know, that if you were, for example, there were particles that every cell gave off a particle, which then was traveled through the blood and was collected in the reproductive organs and passed on to your children. But the key point was that if something happened in your life, for example, if you studied hard, then your neurons became superior, then they would give off superior particles, and these would be inherited by your children. Now, this idea was anathema to his cousin, who was named Francis Galton. So, and Galton wanted just to believe that intelligence, in particular, was inherited, and that nothing that happened in your life could affect it. This was a deeply held conviction of his. So, right at the beginning of this, there was this conflict between the two. Even though Galton didn't admit to Darwin that he had a different agenda, his agenda was to disprove the theory of pangenesis. And without telling Darwin about his true motives, he he enlisted Darwin as a collaborator on joint experiments to disprove this. So it is an interesting a circuitous route to the truth.
But eventually, somehow, the scientific method, as it's called, has a way of allowing reality to be understood, of real facts coming out, of theories being proven or disproven. How does that happen, and how did that happen in the field of genetics?
Well, I mean, over and over again, you can see a wrong idea, for example, like Darwin's pangenesis idea, giving rise to the right idea. Because these ideas are tested. Someone will take up an idea that a previous person has had and test it himself. Or in the case of Galton, someone will be motivated by a private agenda and yet have the right idea. I mean, it turns out that Galton, for the wrong reasons, was right about the science, that he wanted to believe that that intelligence was inherited, which may or may not be true. But it is certainly true that experience can't affect the genes. And this was tested over and over again in the course of history. I mean, that was in the 1860s. And all the way in the 1930s, again, this idea that what happens in your life can affect genes, this is a Lamarckian idea, was came to fruit in Russia, where there was a big push for these Lamarckian ideas to improve plants by subjecting them to different environments. And this – so here it was again tested, but here it was a fiasco, and it ended up ruining agricultural science in the Soviet Union. And that was the last reemergence of these Lamarckian ideas and the death of them. And it also actually sort of killed agriculture and the economy in the Soviet Union for about 20 years.
So through the constant testing, the peer reviewing theories and constant testing of these theories and experimentation, ideas get sorted out, and those that stand the most to the most experimentation prevail, and those that don't stand up do fall by the wayside.
Yes, as long as there's a free testing of ideas. You can't have interference of government, as it was made manifest in the Soviet Union. It was horrible. You know, that Stalin had an idea about how inheritance should work and imposed it on science, which was he actually made genetics illegal for 20 years. So as long as ideas are tested and allowed to progress forward, I mean, also corporate interests in our country can often interfere with the testing and development of ideas. And you can see it in pharmaceutical companies pushing certain kinds of explanations for the way drugs work, which interfere with finding out how they really work.
I'm speaking with James Schwartz, author of In Pursuit of the Gene, From Darwin to DNA. Part of the history of the field of genetics is the sordid issue of eugenics. And that may be another example of how the sort of frailties of human nature can get entangled in scientific inquiry. Tell us about that and how you write about that in your book.
Well, it's actually very interesting the way that eugenics and genetics, the development of both, the evolution of both, are extremely closely tied, because the term eugenics was invented by Francis Galton, who was Darwin's first cousin, and he believed in the strictly hereditarian view of intelligence, and first of all, what he meant by it was that he, like animals and plants, he thought that you could breed better people by selecting the most fit, in his case, the most intelligent people, and allowing them only to breed with each other. And he set out an entire social agenda, and he believed there should be a golden register where the most fit are registered, and that they're only allowed to mate with each other, and that the less fit should be prevented from mating one with another. And in fact, Darwin, who was much more cautious and reasonable, really, tried to warn and mollify, to lessen Galton's involvement in eugenics and keep him motivated towards eugenics. But out of it's his eugenics passion that kept him moving forward in his science, just both at once. he had noticed, for example, that after his experiments with Darwin, he started to do his own experiments on inheritance. And he noticed that if you bred, for example, peas from large peas, gave rise to plants that gave large peas but not as large as the parents. And likewise, very small peas gave rise to plants that gave small peas but not as small. And he considered this regression. He called it regression to the mean. And it was regression to the mean. It worried him because he thought that the natural selection, you know, he was trying to breed a better population, that was his fixation. So he thought, well, it won't work because everyone will regress to the mean. And this panicked him. And regression, and it was actually based on the sort of mystical idea that there was an ideal mean toward which we all regress, which was very unscientific.
Mm-hmm.
But out of this came the idea of regression and the larger concept of correlation, which is one of the cornerstones of modern statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, his biology was entirely wrong. And yet he gave rise – this is a nice example of some of how these two things can go together. He gave – this idea of regression is key and central to the development of genetics and statistics.
James, how do you make sense of the fact that there is so little public understanding of science and how science works? And in the writing of your book, you know, has the public understanding of science changed over time?
Well, I think that for very abstract sciences like genetics, they're very people are put off by them when they're presented as cold hard facts, and they're difficult to grasp. And my belief is that in the teaching of science, we've sort of gone wrong. That we should present science as it truly evolves, with all the missteps, and in that way, you can see where an idea came from, and have a better chance of and it's more interesting a better chance of understanding the complexity of by seeing it in its human dimensions. This is true in genetics. I also think it's true in math and physics. I mean, there's an effort to cover one's tracks and just present ideas abstractly.
And that's where the scientists can be guilty. Of obscuring how the science works.
Right. They don't want to reveal the mess which is behind their work very often.
Well, how has your book been received in pursuit of the gene? And, you know, how important do you think it is for people to understand the way in which science works? And do scientists embrace this history?
Well, scientists are, you know, they have their own agendas. Like, for example, the Genome Project. Those guys, they want to be the inventors of the whole notion that there are complex diseases with complex genetic backgrounds. But in fact, they're not. You know, this history goes back to the early part of the 20th century, to 1913, in fact, when the whole idea of complex traits, polygenic traits, traits influenced by many genes, was framed by the great genius of 20th century genetics, whose name was Hermann Muller. And some people in the Genome Project were very happy that my book revealed the rich history that precedes the current effort to find genes. And you know, others, it takes away from their glory because they wanted to be the de novo inventors of something new.
Right. There's also certainly much to be said for those seeking personal glory in science. But as we've talked about in the end, and as your book reveals very interestingly, the way in which science is, in fact, a sort of community pursuit does allow the truth to evolve and to come out in the end.
Yeah, I mean, another great example of this is that there was a wrong idea about evolution, that it went in great leaps, and this idea was laid out in detail by a Dutch botanist named de Vries, and it was in pursuing this idea, in looking for species, inventing mutations, that the modern classical genetics arose, that in a fruit fly, it was while looking for a species-inventing mutation that a white eye, which is the beginning of classical genetics, was found.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. James Schwartz, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
The book is called In Pursuit of the Gene, From Darwin to DNA. And for Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, men love to wonder, and that is the seed of science. That's Ralph Waldo Emerson. That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day.